The best TV shows and movies are the ones where characters are faced with moral quandaries that explore the gray area between good and evil. People like to imagine what they would do in those situations and can easily see themselves on either side. In real life, though, we fit people into black and white categories. A decision is either right or wrong, and someone is either good or evil. We often want to categorize people so much that we'll create a fictionalized version of that person in order to shove them into one of those two boxes. Christopher Columbus is one of those people. You probably have one of two views of Columbus. You might think that he was a brave explorer who proved the world was round and by doing so discovered the United States, and if that's the case, congratulations on graduating from elementary school. Now, I know every grown-up says this, but a lot of things are gonna change for you, not just for you personally, but for all the things that you think you know, so enjoy it while it lasts. But odds are, you probably think,
Columbus was an incompetent buffoon who never even set foot in America.
Christopher Columbus was actually an idiot and dum-dum.
He got lost coming here, and he's the one that named us Indians because he thought he was in India.
He was a doofus who was terrible at math.
Yes! I'm one of history's greatest monsters!
Well, that's quite the contrast. Well, let's take a look at the facts and see if we can't figure out which ones have been misunderstood, misattributed, exaggerated, and sometimes straight up fabricated. Wow, that was a lot of big words. I kind of feel like Johnny Cochran, only way underpaid. Might as well start at the beginning, right?
Columbus couldn't have discovered that the Earth was round because in his time, it was already common knowledge.
A globe's for sale. A perfectly ordinary globe's for sale.
The way Adam phrases this makes it seem like Columbus thought he was the first person to conclude that the world is round. He didn't, nor did he ever claim to. People since ancient times knew that the world was round. Nobody thought that the world was flat.
Some people probably thought that the world was flat. Some people today think that the world is flat. Some people are idiots.
But I also want to bring attention to those perfectly ordinary globes. Globes weren't exactly common back then. In fact, this is the oldest surviving globe in the world, made in 1493, completely separate from Columbus. Here's a question for you. What continent are we looking at? You don't have to answer right now, but just tuck that away in the back of your mind for now. This projection of people saying what they think Columbus thought doesn't end, especially when it's ridiculous.
My math says the Earth is teeny tiny and shaped like a pear, and at the top it has a succulent nipple.
He actually believed that?
Yes, I actually believe this.
Do I actually have to talk about this? No, he didn't think that the world was shaped like a pear with a nipple on top. In fact, I had never even heard this claim before, but luckily Adam gives us his source, who actually never says that Columbus thought that the world was shaped like a pear. In fact, she says, putting all of this together, Columbus reasoned that the world was shaped like a ball with a breast-like protuberance. Breast-like protuberance. On his third voyage, he wrote a rather poetic letter describing how he felt himself not just crossing the ocean, but going up it. Had he reached the very tip of the protuberance, he would have sailed straight into the terrestrial paradise. So what does he mean by that? Well, back in the day, maps were often oriented with east on top, not north. And at the very far end of the east, or on top of the map, you would find the earthly paradise, also known as the Garden of Eden. This paradise was often depicted as sitting on top of a protuberance. In one letter in 1498, Columbus ponders if this depiction of the Earth might be accurate, and then never mentions it again.
The Earth is tiny, and also a pear. Give me money, please.
This money's an idiot.
See what he did there? He took something that Columbus poetically pondered once during his third voyage and made it look like he presented this idea to the King and Queen of Spain. They didn't fund his expedition just to make him go away. The Ottomans had just defeated the Byzantines and froze Europe out of the spice trade, and since Portugal was going all in on conquering Africa, and Spain had just kicked the Moors off of their peninsula, they were ready to get in on that whole exploration and colonization game. So what about this whole thinking that the world was tiny thing that people keep repeating? Yeah. That's not true either. People knew the circumference of the Earth, more or less. Turns out Columbus went with less, but still. What they didn't know was how big the ocean was, or how big Asia. Remember when I asked what continent we were looking at on that globe? It's Asia. Here's his globe projected onto a piece of paper, and here's a slightly less confusing version of that same projection. They thought Asia was much larger, but this isn't the guy I want to talk about because he's not really connected to Columbus. This is the map Columbus was going by, made by Toscanelli in 1474. This is China on the globe we saw earlier, and this is China on Toscanelli's map. It was Toscanelli who told Columbus, "The voyage is not only possible, but it is true and certain to be honorable, and to yield incalculable profit."
miscalculate the distance to what you wrongly think is Japan, even though people have been calculating the circumference of the Earth pretty well for centuries using sticks in the ground and shadows and math.
He calculates the journey from Spain will take him just 21 days. He underestimates the distance by 7,000 miles.
What was striking about this is that any educated person at the time would know that Columbus was wrong.
I guess by any educated person, they mean not Toscanelli, who is widely viewed as one of the great cartographers of his time, which is why Adam throws this in the background to make it look like Columbus wasn't listening to Toscanelli, when he clearly was. It's actually pretty good attention to detail that the map Columbus was pointing to in that Mankind scene is Toscanelli's map. So where did they get that whole 7,000 miles off thing? This is what Columbus was aiming for. Sepangu, which is supposed to be Japan. Obviously, this isn't where Japan really is, but that is where everyone thought it was. It wasn't Columbus's calculation of the distance that was off. It was any educated person's positioning of Japan. Columbus was also hoping that there would be uncharted islands off of the east coast of Japan. So when he landed here, that's what he thought he found.
And died thinking he had made it to India.
People saying that you're not in Asia insist that you are.
He didn't think he was in China, he didn't think he was in India, he thought he was somewhere new. Off the coast of Japan, but still, somewhere new. Remember, he landed here, which, there is no land on the map right here, so what was he supposed to think? And here are the actual land masses. Columbus landed on the island of Hispaniola, which is 7,000 miles away from Japan. That's where they got that number. So I suppose he got kind of lucky that he accidentally discovered some new land.
He didn't discover America, and he didn't prove the Earth was round.
Columbus was a savage man who didn't discover North America, didn't prove the Earth was round.
This is something that you've heard everywhere, and it's probably already down in the comments. Whenever Adam says America, he's specifically referring to the United States, which is weird. The Some News segment is a little more honest by saying North America, which is true, he didn't land in North America. So let's talk about the guy who did, Leif Erikson. In 985, the Vikings set up two settlements in Greenland. If you didn't already know this, the name was just a sales technique to get more settlers. Greenland is very much not green, which meant that the settlers had to travel further west in order to find timber. Erikson's winter camp at Lonso Meadows, Newfoundland lasted 1 year before being abandoned. The Greenland settlements were mostly forgotten by the rest of Europe during the Black Plague, and they were finally abandoned in 1408. I personally have a problem with people who say that the Vikings discovered America first. Imagine it's 2010 and someone offers to sell you Bitcoin at 10 cents a piece. You decline it because it's stupid and worthless. Now it's 2017 and Bitcoin is worth $10,000 a piece. So you go around telling everyone how you could have been rich because you knew about Bitcoin back in the day, but you never did anything with it. Okay, now swap out Bitcoin for America and extend the timeline out to 500 years. The Vikings didn't discover America first. They stumbled on it looking for timber, stayed for a year, and then left. And not only did they never come back, but they just plain forgot about it. Their find amounted to nothing. Columbus's discovery, on the other hand, opened up both halves of the world to each other and changed world history forever. On his third voyage in 1498, he landed here, which he named the Gulf of Paria, and then he named all of this Paria. This is the terrestrial paradise that he was talking about in that previous letter. He describes that the land of Paria is a mighty continent that was hitherto unknown. So not only did he know he found something new, but he was describing the South American continent. He thought that the Caribbean, as well as this new continent, lied to the southeast of Asia, which is also what people like Amerigo Vespucci believed. Amerigo Vespucci is an interesting character in our story, because he was full of shit. He straight up made up two voyages, so historians take what he has to say with a grain of salt. But while he was in the service of Portugal in 1502, he was mapping the South American coast, and soon realized that he was further south than anything previously mapped in Asia. So he too thought that this must be a previously unknown fourth continent. But his letters don't describe huge river deltas that would have been impossible to miss if he was actually there, so... This was 4 years after Columbus described Paria as a hitherto unknown continent. And just like Columbus, Amerigo thought that this new continent lied to the south of Asia. So why is it called America? The usual story goes that Amerigo beat Columbus to the punch when it came to publishing his findings, and the name was eventually settled on in 1507 by the Waldseemüller map. Unfortunately, it's just not that cut and dry. This is the map, the Universalis Cosmographia. And here is the new fourth continent, named America, the female Latinized version of Amerigo's name. But up here to the north, we see a smaller fifth continent named Parias. the Latinized, you get it. Walt C. Mueller didn't settle the dispute or settle on a name. He credits both Columbus and Amerigo in the top left corner of the map. There are still a few interesting things to note on this map though. Like this. This is still Cipangu, which is supposed to be Japan. And there are a number of places on the east coast of America which are also on the east coast of India. Which shows that educated people still weren't sure if America and Asia were connected or not. Anyway, the name Pariahs eventually falls out of favor when they realize that North and South America are actually connected. Though even in 1587, Mercator named the northern half America, or New India? So you know, it took people a while to settle on a name. So now that we've cleared all that up, kind of, and we're in America, we need to discuss how primitive or not primitive the Native Americans were. People on both sides tend to lump all Native Americans in together. They're two huge continents spanning thousands of miles. What's true for one tribe isn't necessarily true for another. If one tribe mapped all the stars and created an almanac, that doesn't mean they all did. If one tribe didn't use the wheel, that doesn't mean they all didn't.
Some of them did invent a wheel. They just didn't use them for hauling because they hadn't domesticated draft animals yet.
I would have been fine with that statement until he said the word yet. This implies that given enough time, they would have eventually when... No, they wouldn't have. Ever. Not because they're intellectually inferior or anything like that, but because they had a really difficult spawn point. There are no draft animals or work or pack animals in the Americas. There are no horses, donkeys, or camels. And because of that, they hit somewhat of a cap on their civilization tech tree. You can't really have large cities without animals. In fact, with the exception of llamas and guinea pigs in Peru, they didn't have any domesticated animals. There were no cows, pigs, or chickens to share diseases with, so Native Americans were incredibly vulnerable and susceptible to disease. Again, not because of any genetic inferiority, but because of their difficult starting location. Since Europeans and Asians had been living in close proximity with animals for centuries, they had built up somewhat of an immunity to animal diseases, like cowpox, chickenpox, and the various swine and avian flus. So on Columbus's second voyage, when smallpox was introduced to the New World, it burned through the entire continent, killing 90% of the Native American population, before they had even heard of a European. This was inevitable and unavoidable. Whether it was Columbus, any of the people who followed him, or even a Chinese explorer coming the other way. It was also unintentional at this point. The whole smallpox blankets thing doesn't happen until way later in the 1700s. The point is that by 1600, 90% of the native population had died. So when the first North American colonists showed up in 1607 and 1620, they found most of the land to be pretty much uninhabited. Pre-Columbian population numbers for North America vary widely, from 50 to 100 million. But everyone pretty much agrees on that 90% disease mortality number, so we're talking about 5 to 10 million people in 1600 spread across the entire continent. Before you go thinking that that's exceptionally bad, remember that 150 years before Columbus, Europe lost 50 to 60% of its population to the Black Plague. These epidemics just kind of happened.
If you don't count the quarter million Taino people that live there already.
Occupied? Someone lives here?
Right, I know this part. He thought he made it to India.
We've covered this already.
What a silly mistake.
Yes, if by silly you mean brutal.
Brutal is not a synonym for silly.
The Taino treated Columbus and his crew with the utmost hospitality.
Hug?
We need reinforcements!
That's not how it happened. Columbus didn't freak out and go get reinforcements. On his first trip, he bounced around a few islands, left 40 people to set up a fort, and returned home to report his findings. The king and queen sent him back after only 6 months with the expressed purpose of establishing more permanent settlements. So what did Columbus think when he first saw the natives?
Did enslave and brutalize the nice people he found. There are journal entries literally from him describing the natives being kind and bringing them things, having no knowledge of guns so they'd be easy to enslave.
Okay, that is a lot to unpack. But this is something that people bring up all the time, that in his own words and in his own journals, he says this or that. The most common quotes are the ones he shows. So let's start with this one about them making good servants. What do you notice about this quote? How about the fact that it's neither the beginning nor the end of the sentence? There's clearly more to it. So we're gonna have to look it up. And here it is. It appears to me that the people are ingenious and would be good servants, and I am of the opinion that they would very readily become Christians, as they appear to have no religion. They very quickly learn such words as are spoken to them. In full context, the word servant could mean slave, or servant of God, or subject of the crown. When they just cut out the ingenious good servant part, it only means slave. They remove any context and any doubt. But these are Columbus's own words. We have to take them at face value since we can't figure out what he really meant, right? Do you see where I'm going with this yet? These aren't his own words, because his real name wasn't Christopher Columbus, it was Cristoforo Colombo. Oh look, what do we have here? Yes, I really do have that kind of time on my hands. Here's what we're looking for from October 11, 1492. Now we have to translate it. Let's just shove it into Google Translate and see what we get. They must be good servants and of good wit that I see that very quickly he says everything he told them, blah blah. Obviously Google isn't the best translator since it doesn't carry meaning very well, but it takes some linguistic gymnastics to get from they must be good servants and of good wit to the people are ingenious and would be good servants. They pick the absolute worst, most biased translation to quote as journal entries literally from him. Fun fact, the Italian translation of his journals don't have the word servant at all. Instead, they translate it as servant of God or... For more on how bias can influence how the same words can be translated to mean wildly different things, might I suggest watching the movie Arrival? I'm not going to walk you through the process for every single quote, but there is another one people like to refer to. I could conquer the whole of them with 50 men and govern them as I please. Here's the Spanish, and here's what Google Translate says. Because with 50 men, they are all subjugated, and it will make them do everything they want? Okay, that ending doesn't really make all that much sense, but I can tell you what it doesn't say. Conquer them and govern them as I please. But just to be sure, let's look at a different translation of the same quote. For with 50 men, they can all be subjugated and made to do what is required of them. The words conquer or govern don't appear here either. Again, they pick the worst possible translation to highlight. Again, in full context, in this section, Columbus is asking the king and queen what they want done with the natives, suggesting that 50 men would be all that's required to hold the island. There is nothing about governing them as he pleases. And while we have Columbus's journals open, there's one more thing I'd like to point out.
Let's say I brought a bunch of Indians back to Europe to show off, and most of them died on the boat ride over. Because that's true, I did that, that happened. Just say that you only meant to bring 6 in the first place.
Okay, well, let's see what he has to say in his own words. Conveniently, the sentence in question is right after the first quote we looked at. If it please our Lord, I intend at my return to carry home 6 of them to your highnesses, that they may learn our language. This was written 2 months before his journey home. So unless they're implying that Columbus had a time machine and was able to change what he said from the start, and there's yet another aspect to this that I want to bring up. None of Columbus's original journals survive. All we have are transcriptions of his journal written by someone who's probably already been mentioned in the comments below. Bartolomé de las Casas. People often incorrectly say that Las Casas traveled with Columbus. Nope, he arrived in April 1502 with Nicolas de Ovando, 3 months before Columbus's fourth voyage arrived in the New World. As far as we can tell, they never crossed paths. Bartolomé de las Casas was a noble who was given an encomienda in the New World. Encomienda was the Spanish feudal system of lords and peasants, and that's what the natives were. Peasants, not slaves. Columbus wanted to subjugate them, which means turn them into subjects of the crown, not enslave them. They were forced to work against their will, but nobody owned them. Nobody could buy or sell them. In 1515, Las Casas gave up his encomienda and advocated instead for the use of African slaves. That's right, the protector of the natives, as he would later be called, advocated for the transatlantic slave trade, which then started under Nicolas de Ovando, not Columbus.
He slaughtered the opposition and became the progenitor of the transatlantic slave trade.
And not his son either.
But Diego has built on my work with the Indians, helping to found a triangular trade route that represents the world's first multinational process streamlining the transatlantic free labor market, insourcing African workers.
In 1530, he transcribed Columbus's journals, and then in 1542, he wrote a short account of the destruction of the Indies, which is the thing that a lot of people point to as Las Casas saying Columbus was evil. He only mentions Columbus once, and it's rather neutral, really. The account is about the people who followed Columbus, most notably de Ovando, who is best known for his brutal treatment of the native Taino people of Hispaniola. Keep that in mind, it becomes important later. Columbus was removed as governor of Hispaniola in 1500 and put in jail. not because of his brutal treatment of the natives, but because of his mismanagement of the colony, which meant that he wasn't extracting enough gold, and because of complaints from the Spanish colonists.
Chop off people's hands. Cut off people's noses and hands unless they give you silver, right?
He was doing that to the Spanish. I'm sure he also did that to the natives, but the king and queen didn't really care about the natives at this point. But his punishment was that he was removed as governor and put in jail for a total of 6 weeks, after which he was given everything back and sent out on his fourth voyage, so you can see how much they really cared about punishing him. But it was while he was arrested that he wrote an important letter.
Girls as young as 9 years old were sold into sexual slavery.
My customers wanted New World sex slaves, and I heard them.
Actual Christopher Columbus quote.
That actual Christopher Columbus quote comes from that important letter I just mentioned, where he complains about the robbing and sexual slavery of natives, which is why he cut off colonists' hands and noses, and that the violence of the calumny of turbulent persons has injured me more than my services have profited me, which is a bad example for the present and the future. Am I saying that Columbus was a good person? No. But am I saying that he was against the very thing that people say he was for? Yes, that's exactly what I'm saying. Yes. They're quoting his complaint about something happening and saying he was doing it. That's, talk about taking something out of context. So Columbus was not governor when Las Casas arrived. Las Casas had already given up his encomienda and started the slave trade by the time he transcribed Columbus's journals. So at this point, he has every incentive to make Columbus look as bad as possible. In fact, it's common knowledge that he paraphrased and exaggerated. This is made even worse by Black Legend, which is a propaganda campaign by English historians to make the Spanish look much worse than they really were. So when people say from Columbus's own journals, what they really mean is from one specific 1892 English translation of the 1530 transcripts of Columbus's journals, originally written 40 years earlier. I hate to draw this comparison, but it's kind of like directly quoting Jesus. He didn't speak English. What you're actually reading is a centuries-old translation of a third-person account of what he said, written hundreds of years afterwards. Oh yeah, that's another thing. Those original transcripts and even the translations of Columbus's journals are written in third-person too.
Columbus's regime was so senselessly brutal that by 1542, the Taino population on the island had fallen to 200.
As we've already established, Columbus's regime only lasted until 1500. Adam is attributing an entire 50-year span to one person, 42 of which weren't even under Columbus. Do you even remember who the president was 42 years ago? De Ovando, who was the most brutal if you remember, was in charge for longer than Columbus. 50 years is a long time. That's two or three generations. Not only was Columbus dead, but his kids were dead. I mentioned this in my Oregon Trail video, but this is another example of someone taking something that occurred over decades and compressing it down to blame it all on one guy. 50 years is twice as long as the Oregon Trail was in use. So okay, something else that really stuck out to me is that 200 number. No matter what source you look up, you'll see the 1542 population numbers around 2,000 to 5,000. Which is still small, don't get me wrong, but it's 10 to 25 times larger than what Adam says. So where did he get this? Here. By 1542, there were fewer than 200. But wait a second, did you notice something? Here, Adam says that the Taino population in 1492 was 250,000, which is pretty accurate to what most everyone else says. But in Adam's source, it says the population was 1.1 million, which is ridiculous. So don't use the source when the numbers are wildly unbelievable, but go ahead and use it when it fits your narrative, I guess. So how many people did Columbus and his men kill, and does that count as genocide? If we take that 250,000 number and subtract the 90% mortality rate from disease, the answer is that it doesn't matter. That's not what genocide means. In 2012, George Zimmerman shot and killed Trayvon Martin. That fact is beyond dispute, but he was found innocent. How is that possible? Because he was tried for murder, not manslaughter. Murder requires an intent to kill. Zimmerman didn't leave his house that morning saying, "I'm gonna kill a black kid today." Proving intent when the only witness is the perpetrator is nearly impossible, and intent matters when we're trying to define a crime. After the Vegas shooting a few months ago, many people wanted the crime labeled as an act of terrorism. Terrorism is the use of violence or the fear of violence to further a political agenda. There was no stated political purpose or message behind the shooting, it was just a senseless mass murder. The intent is what matters. So when we look at what happened with Columbus and his men, there's no denying that mass killings took place. I am not trying to deny, excuse, or minimize what happened. But when trying to label the crime as genocide, we have to look at the intent. Genocide, as defined by the UN, is an act committed with intent to destroy, in whole or in part, a national, ethnical, racial, or religious group. Columbus's intent was not to
wipe them out. All of them.
In his own words, he wanted to subjugate them. It wasn't racially or ethnically motivated, it was conquest motivated, and those who resisted were killed. When Napoleon was trying to take over Europe, he killed hundreds of thousands, and we don't call that genocide. The end result is the same, whether we're talking about Trayvon Martin, the Vegas shooting, or Columbus. People were killed, and that's awful. But when trying to label a crime as manslaughter, murder, terrorism, or genocide, it's the intent that matters.
For centuries, Columbus was a historical footnote. But that changed in 1828 when Washington Irving, the author of The Legend of Sleepy Hollow and other tall tales, wrote the first English-language biography of Columbus.
Historical footnote. Right. That's why this state capital, the district of the nation's capital, this state capital, and this territory were all named after him. Not to mention all of the other cities and counties in the US and an entire country in South America. All before 1828. Truth is that Columbus and his imagined female goddess form, Columbia, have been part of the American story since the beginning. Here she is telling you to ration food during World War I, and here she is in the painting that you all know, even if you're not American, as the depiction of manifest destiny. Admittedly, American folklore has probably turned him into a bigger deal than he should be given his rather minimal involvement in US history, which is why I personally don't think that we should have a day to celebrate him. But conversely, I also disagree with just renaming it Indigenous Peoples Day, because what is it really?
Columbus.
Christopher Columbus.
That's a big fuck you.
It's just anti-Columbus Day. Think about it, what do people do on Indigenous Peoples Day? They hate Columbus, burn him in effigy, and hold mock trials of him. If you want to have a day where we celebrate Native history and Native cultures, then let's do that. Don't just name swap it and make it Hate on Columbus Day. We don't have a day where we hate on objectively more evil people like Hitler or Stalin. It's weird. Was Columbus a good guy? No. Was he a bad guy? If we look at him through the historical lens, not really, he wasn't any worse than anyone else. But if we hold him up to modern standards, yeah, he was a pretty bad guy. Columbus is just one part, the first part, but a relatively small part in what happened to the Native Americans. So why do people hate Columbus? Or rather, why do people want to hate Columbus? Why do some people seem to exaggerate and in some cases fabricate evidence in order to discredit, downplay, and demonize him? Well, Wonder Woman got it right.
Maybe people aren't always good. You don't think I wish I could tell you that it was one bad guy to blame? It's not!
Day of Ondo was objectively worse, Cortez and the other conquistadors were objectively worse, and the US government, most of the time anyway, was objectively worse. But even more than that, all of the unnamed soldiers under these people were the absolute worst. But despite all of that, Columbus is the one that everyone can name. To many people, Columbus deserves none of the credit for discovering America, but all of the blame for what happened to it. If we can pin 400 years of awful history onto one guy, it shifts all of the guilt for what happened to the Native Americans away from the rest of us. Well, the rest of you, because my relatives didn't come over until after the close of the Indian Wars, so not me. Putting people into nice, neat little boxes of good and evil just isn't that simple. People are more complicated than that, and deep down we all know it. We just don't want it to be true. We want a villain to blame. And the next time someone tells you that Columbus was responsible for the genocide of millions, or they tell you that he thought that the world was shaped like a pear, hopefully now you know better. So what do you think? Was Columbus the most evil who ever eviled, or just a man of his time? Whose story should I deconstruct next? Let me know down in the comments, and don't forget to discover that subscribe button. Yes, this is chocolate, and I can't wait for all of you to tell me how dangerous this is in the comments below. At least it'll be a nice change from everyone calling me a racist. When you're done with that, follow me on Facebook and Twitter, and join the conversation on the subreddit.
Welcome to the Why I Love America podcast. We are the Paul Brothers, and we have an awesome guest today, Mr. Tad R. Collister, who has written several different books and things that advocate for the actual teaching of history, as I would say.
What is the main book that you put out recently about American history that everyone should read?
Well, it's entitled America's Destiny, and it's designed to go to primary sources to find the truth, rather than relying on secondary sources or one's own opinion.
Mm-hmm. Which my mother-in-law, she actually sent me one of your books while I was on a military activation, and it was America's Destiny, because there was two versions of it, right?
Yes.
Okay, I think she sent me the first one, but that was the first time I had ever learned anything like that about Christopher Columbus because of this narrative around Columbus just being an absolute demon of a man. And so your book kind of gave me some resources to where I could learn kind of the other side.
Yeah, so tell us a little bit, because as Jackson pointed out, the general concept around Christopher Columbus that's being taught in the schools is that he was seeking merely earthly gain. He wanted to look cool, and he wanted to have a bunch of money, and when he came over, he just wanted to enslave people so that he could get more money and look more cool, right? And that's kind of the idea that they put forward with Christopher Columbus. But what you're saying is that is not the case. Christopher Columbus is a much more complicated and richer personality than just that.
That's true. And I'm just a common guy who wanted to find out the truth about Columbus.
Mm-hmm.
So I ordered all of the books that I could find on Columbus, the primary sources that are in English.
Mm-hmm.
And one was the diary and letters of Christopher Columbus, because I wanted to find out what he himself said.
Interesting.
Another was a biography by his son, who accompanied him on some of his voyages, Ferdinand Columbus. Another, probably the most acclaimed, was by a Spanish historian and a friar named Bartolomé de las Casas.
Yeah.
Who lived in Hispaniola, which now is known as Dominican Republic, in Haiti, and had and defended the Indians, but also gave us a what I would call a correct analysis of
Columbus.
And he points out the Spaniards were terrible with the natives, but he has a completely different viewpoint of Columbus as an individual. Another one of the original sources, I don't have the book with me, was by someone named Peter Martyr, who was an Italian historian, and another one was Andre Bernaldez, who was a Spanish historian and archbishop. And then one that was most helpful was written by an emeritus professor at Stanford. Her name is Carol Delaney. She read all the original sources about Columbus and probably is the greatest expert in the world today on Columbus and who he really was and what he really accomplished.
Wow.
So maybe we can...
So we're standing on a solid foundation, then, is what you're pointing
out. We're going to refer to primary sources mainly, and okay, some secondary sources who quote the primary sources to find out who was this guy,
who
Columbus.
Who Columbus really is. Okay, let's do it. I'm excited.
Well, I think one important thing is, what was Columbus's motive in sailing west?
Mm-hmm.
Now, certainly he wanted to get to the Indies and find the riches for Spain. But why did he want to find all of those riches, and what else did he want to accomplish? So this is what Samuel Eliot Morison said. He was a Pulitzer Prize biographer on the life of Columbus. And maybe one of you could read that for us, what he said about Columbus.
Samuel Eliot Morison, he said, "There can be no doubt that the faith of Columbus was genuine and sincere, and that his frequent communion with forces unseen was a vital element in his achievement. This conviction that God destined him to be an instrument for spreading the faith was far more potent than the desire to win glory, wealth, and worldly honors, to which he was certainly far from indifferent."
Well, as I read, I found out that Columbus had two main motives sailing west. One was to convert the indigenous people to Christianity.
Okay.
And you know what the second one was?
What's that?
I have a cool story.
To use the gold to reconquer Jerusalem so they could build a temple for the second coming of Christ.
Way. I've never heard
now
that.
Let's read. You don't read about that in your school books.
No, that's pretty wild.
But let's just go on and read a little more. This is Columbus who said, "I feel persuaded by the many and wonderful manifestations of divine providence in my especial favor that I am the chosen instrument of God in bringing to pass a great event, no less than the conversion of millions who are now existing in darkness of paganism."
Mm.
Now, Carol Delaney, who was the Stanford professor who wrote this book, Maybe you could read what she had to say about, after reading all the original sources, what did she have to say about Columbus? Yeah,
Carol Delaney, she said, Columbus had time to think about the meaning of the journey and his role in it. He was beginning to think of himself as the Christ bearer, like his namesake, Saint Christopher, carrying the Christian faith across the waters. So she's saying that Christopher, like the etymology of it, literally means Christ bearer?
Yes.
Interesting. Wow. That's very interesting.
Interesting that that should be attached to his name.
To his name.
Right.
Wow.
Well, so, now, oh, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to ask. So for those who are listening, Christopher Columbus, because there may be some critics that are listening. They're like, okay, well, yeah, maybe he did have this religious thing, but religion bad. And that's what a lot of people in today's society thinks. It's religion bad. Christopher Columbus, his goal wasn't to go and force everybody into Christianity or anything like that. It was to share the good news, correct? And how was that received when he got over there?
Well, we're going to talk a little bit about how it was received, but let me have you cite one of the quotes that talks about how he wanted the profits from the gold to be used. Mm-hmm. Why don't you read Columbus there?
Columbus said, I urge your highnesses to spend all the profits of this my enterprise on the conquest of Jerusalem. Being a devoutly religious man, Columbus believed this conquest and the rebuilding of the temple was necessary in order to prepare the way for the second coming of Christ.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So he had two great goals, one to convert the people to Christianity, to a higher way of life, and two, reconquer Jerusalem and rebuild the temple and prepare for the second coming of Christ. Hmm. Now, in a letter to the Pope, 1493, Columbus writes, this enterprise was undertaken with the purpose of expending what was invested in aiding or rebuilding the Holy Temple and the Holy Church. You don't find that anywhere in Howard Zinn or the school teachings today. So at one point, Carol Delaney, who was the leading expert on Columbus, was asked a very interesting question in an interview. Alan Pulaski said, the popular view today is that Columbus is responsible for countless atrocities against the native people. Mm-hmm. Pulaski asked her if she felt this was a fair assessment.
What'd she say?
Would you like to know?
Yeah.
This is her answer. No, not at all. The more I read of his own writings and that of his contemporaries, the primary sources, my understanding of him totally changed. His relations with the natives tended to be benign or good. He liked the natives and found them to be very intelligent. Christopher strictly told the crew not to do things like maraud or rape, and instead to treat the native people with respect. There are many examples in his writings where he gave instructions to this effect. Most of the time, when injustices occurred, Columbus wasn't even there. She then added, the critics are blaming Columbus for things he didn't do. I just think he's been terribly maligned. Mm-hmm. That's her summary after reading all of the original sources.
Okay. Wow. And I'm curious, you mentioned a guy, Howard Zinn, you said?
Yes.
So how has he participated in kind of that muddling of Christopher Columbus's history, or help me understand that?
Yes, he's taken a very secular view. He never mentions that Columbus wanted to use the funds to promote Christianity or the retaking of the temple. It was solely because he was greedy, mm-hmm. and he wanted the money for himself and for fame and for Spain. Mm-hmm. He neglects all of these other aspects of what motivated Columbus. In fact, Lacasis, who was the lead historian at the time, summarizes Columbus's life a little bit in these words. And in fact, this is a very critical statement he makes about the Columbus in distinguishing him from the other Spaniards who did commit genocide. Mm-hmm. Could you read this starting right there, the desolation?
Yes. The desolation of these isles and provinces, Hispaniola, took beginning about the year 1504.
Just a second. He's now saying the bad things started to happen in 1504. You know why that year is important?
No. Is that when Christopher Columbus left?
Christopher Columbus had four voyages, mm-hmm. the last one completed in 1504.
Oh, really?
So now what Lacasis is saying, the prime historian, before 1504, There's really few problems. The real problems started after 1504.
When Columbus was no longer there.
Exactly.
Wow. It says, about the year 1504, after Columbus's four voyages were completed and at the time when he had no administrative responsibilities in the New World. For before that time, when Columbus governed in part, very few of the provinces situated in that island were oppressed or spoiled with unjust wars or violated with general devastation as after they were.
Huh. Interesting. So the things that we hear that the Spaniards did to the natives when they came across, they really, really started after Christopher Columbus was no longer there.
Yes. I'm not saying none of it happened, because Columbus, when he would sail back to Spain, he would leave some of his men and they would do bad things, even though he instructed them not to.
Yeah.
But this historian is saying, hey, I just want you to know that the really terrible things took place after Columbus left.
Well, let's talk about these four voyages, because I think most people watching that aren't super interested in American history probably didn't know that Columbus did four voyages. They probably thought he did one voyage, went, and he raped and pillaged, and then he went home with all of his gold. But that is not the case. There were four voyages, and they weren't all the same, if I remember correctly, right?
In fact, maybe for a minute we could focus on the second voyage, because there's an interesting event that took place.
Okay, let's do it.
One of the local tribes helped save one of his ships. It was shipwrecked. And then they said, can you help us out? Because there's a tribe over here that are cannibals. And they come and they take our women and children and eat our men. Holy can you help us conquer them? So Columbus helped conquer them and takes the prisoners of war, and he sends them back to Spain.
Mm-hmm.
People call these slaves. We would call them prisoners of war.
Because they were literally eating.
Literally eating. In fact, we have the first-hand account of Dr. Chanko, who was a physician of the royal court, who was there and describes how they would literally eat the men and little children.
Which, I will say this, that the general idea of the natives and Columbus came over, all the natives are living in perfect peace and harmony with the land and with each other, and then Columbus comes in and just enslaves them all. But this very much shows that even the natives were fighting among themselves and eating each other.
Oh, they were fighting among themselves. They had cannibals. They were sacrificing some of their children, as we'll see, to the gods that they had.
Yeah.
But this is what Columbus says. He sends these cannibals back to Spain. Mm-hmm. Nobody ever reads this letter. Can you read what he says to the king and queen there?
About the, yep. Okay. We send these two vessels, some of these cannibal men and women, as well as some children, both male and female. Their highnesses can order them to be placed under the care of the most competent persons to teach them the language. Columbus then explained in his motives for sending these prisoners of war, that they may one day be led to abandon their barbarous custom of eating their fellow creatures. By learning the Spanish language in Spain, they will much earlier receive baptism and ensure the salvation of their souls. Moreover, it will be a great happiness to the Indians, who do not practice the above-mentioned cruel custom, cannibalism, when they see that that we have seized and led captive those who injure them, whom they dread so much, that their name also fills them with horror. So that's really interesting. Columbus isn't like, take them and enslave them and kill them. He's saying, these people are wicked and they're eating other people. Please teach them Spanish.
And give them real food.
And give them real food so they don't have to eat
and
people
teach
anymore.
Teach them Christianity. And, just, and then he wants to send them back to reclaim their people.
Yes. Holy
now, God. To get a feel for this evil man Columbus that you hear about in schools, let's go to another original source. This is Peter Martyr, an Italian historian. And what does he say right there?
Okay. Peter Martyr says, as he had never mistreated the natives, the inhabitants of Cuba. As he had never mistreated the natives and the inhabitants of Cuba, both men and women gladly brought him gifts to spare no fear.
He never what?
He never mistreated them. So when he came back, the natives were excited to see Columbus again.
A little different than what you get in
the
school books.
Given gifts, displaying no fear.
Okay, because if I remember right, his first trip, he lands there. He meets he meets the natives. They are friends. There's no conflict on the first trip, right? And then he leaves his men behind and goes back to Spain to report. And then when he comes back, some things had happened, right? What were those things that he found when he came back on his second voyage?
Well, he did find at one point that I've forgotten if it's the second or third voyage, but that 39 of his men were dead.
Mm-hmm. All of them, right? It was all of them were dead.
So he went out to war against those who had killed his men. Mm-hmm. Yes.
So it wasn't this unprovoked, he comes over and he's like, all right, now, I was nice the first time, but the second time it'd be mean. He leaves men behind, goes back to Spain, comes back, and all of them are dead. And they had all
and they
been
were killed,
killed
by the natives?
They were killed by the natives. Yeah. And so, but even then, so yes, there was warring, but eventually they came to an agreement and a peace, and it was on that second voyage that he helped him out with the cannibalism.
The cannibals.
Right? And so eventually they made peace once again.
In fact, Howard Zinn talks about how he went from island to island capturing the natives.
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't find one instance where he just took innocent people as captives and sent them back to Spain. Now, on the first voyage, he did take some people back.
Okay.
And honestly, I don't know, because he wanted to show the king and queen of Spain what they were like.
What they found, yeah.
I don't know what the circumstances were, and it's hard from the original writings to find out. Mm-hmm. But Raphael, who is a historian, I don't know where I have it here, but he went on to say he never captured innocent people.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, on the third voyage, Columbus was sent back in chains.
Yeah. Talk about
himself.
That.
And why? Part of it was because he caused two of his men to be hanged. Mm. You know why? Because they mistreated the natives.
Oh, really?
Yes. So
interesting.
Well, just another thought is I listed out a lot of the misstatements that were made by the revisionist historians, such as Columbus introduced slavery to the New World.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's interesting. The primary sources talk about when the Spaniards came. What do you think the natives gave them as gifts?
Slaves?
Slaves.
No way.
Exactly right. So it's totally false statement.
That they brought slaves over. That is something that is completely false. This idea that slavery didn't exist until Europeans came over to the Americas and they're like, hey, I got an idea. Let's figure this out. When it's like slavery, unfortunately, has been something that has existed since the beginning of time.
Yes.
And it's really sad.
So I took a lot of these revisionist statements. And I talked about the misconception they were when you read the primary sources. Mm-hmm. And I gave it to one of my grandsons
okay.
who was in college.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, okay, Grandpa. I admit the revisionists were wrong on these. But we know Columbus was involved in the sex slave trade.
Mm-hmm.
I said, how do we know that? And he said, we have a quote from his own diary. And
let's read this quote.
In fact, why don't you just read... starting right there, for one woman.
Yeah. All right, so this is his diary. He says, for one woman, they give 100 castellanos as for a farm. And this sort of trading is very common. And there are already a great number of merchants who go in search of girls. There are at this moment from 9 or 10 on sale. They fetch a good price. Let their age be what it will. But revisionists quote this statement out of context. Okay, continue.
Okay, now.
Talk about the context.
I asked my grandson, did you read the sentence right before and the sentence a few after? He said, no, that's not on the internet. I said, well, would you like to know what they say? I say, the sentence before says that Spain should only send men of honor and integrity to the colonies. And a few sentences later, it says, men such as these are not worthy of Christian baptism.
Oh,
so do you think he was endorsing an event or reporting it and condemning it?
Reporting it.
Can we read these? Let's read these.
Yeah,
the sentences. So this is the sentence before. He said, it would be well to send people from Spain and only to send such as are well known that the country may be peopled with honest men. And then after making a reference to the women being sold into slavery, he observed, I aver that a great number of men have been to the Indies who did not deserve baptism in the eyes of God or men and who are now returning thither. In other words, it seems Columbus was condemning, not condoning such actions. So he's pretty much just saying, this is what's happening. They're selling women and they sell them for this price. And we shouldn't be sending people that are going to buy women at that price over.
Right. But if you quote it out of context, you don't give the introduction and the follow-up,
uh-huh.
it sounds like he's involved in the sex slave yeah. trade. But we don't have one case of a historical case of Columbus having a slave or mistreating any of these natives by abusing them in a sexual way.
What, did your grandkid change his mind?
He was surprised, yeah. He was surprised.
take that to school.
Also, I think another interesting point I didn't know is when Columbus wrote his will, he donated money to be used to build a church and a hospital for the indigenous natives. So that showed how much he loved them. And I would just say, in terms of him being inspired, this is what he wrote about God's hand in his enterprise.
He said, "With a hand that could be felt, the Lord opened my mind to the fact that it would be possible to sail from here to the Indies and opened my will to desire to accomplish the project. This was the fire that burned within me. Who can doubt that this fire was not merely mine, but also of the Holy Spirit, urging me to press forward?" Wow.
He knew that the Holy Ghost was inspiring him in this calling. And then maybe just in conclusion, how did the contemporary historians summarize Columbus's life? Nobody was perfect, and I'm sure he made mistakes along the way and lived in a different culture than we did. But this is Lacasis, Bartolome Lacasis, who is the greatest defender of the Native American Indians we maybe ever had.
He's the one who wrote that book, that In Defense of the Indians.
Exactly,
right.
Okay. Right. Now he's summarizing Columbus's life, and this is what he says in those two statements.
Okay.
Here, Lacasis.
Lacasis says this, and this is the guy who loves the natives. So if someone's going to be condemning someone for mistreating the natives, it's
exactly right.
And he says, "I think Christopher Columbus was the most outstanding sailor in the world, versed like no other in the art of navigation, for which divine providence chose him to accomplish the most outstanding feat ever accomplished in the world until now. Many is the time I have wished that God would again inspire me to extol the indescribable service to God and to the whole world which Christopher Columbus rendered at the cost of such pain and dangers, such skill and expertise when he so courageously discovered the new world." So, yeah, he's not saying that this guy was terrible. And then he says, "Truly this man had a good and Christian purpose."
Well, that's his summary
mm-hmm.
of Christopher Columbus.
Yeah.
The one who the school books say was involved in the sex slave, who didn't love the natives. Columbus loved the native people mm-hmm. again and again. He talks about his great love and converting them to the holy faith by persuasion and mm-hmm. love. And then Samuel Eliot Morison, who was the Pulitzer Prize winner, kind of summarized Columbus's life as follows.
All right. Morison says, "The whole history of the Americas stems from the four voyages of Columbus. Today, a score of independent nations and dominions unite in homage to Christopher, who carried Christian civilization across the ocean sea."
Yeah.
Oh, my God. Here's my question, Tad, is what is the motivation, I guess, that people have to demonize him so much that we've gotten to this point with the education of him?
I think it primarily comes from people who don't have a belief in God's involvement in America, and they don't want to attribute that God inspired Columbus and that Columbus was trying to convert people to Christianity. Hmm. And when you weigh their type of life they had versus what Western civilization brought, there were obviously problems. But they were they had sacrifices of their own children. They had cannibalism. They had constant wars. In fact, maybe the last statement could be, this was an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal by a Peruvian who looks back on Columbus's life and what he accomplished. And this is what he says in the Wall Street Journal. That kind of puts it in perspective.
So this is Alejandro Bermudez. A Peruvian-American wrote the op-ed in the Wall Street Journal, and he said, "As a Catholic, I particularly value Columbus for bringing the first of many missionaries who showed millions of people the path to salvation. Human sacrifice was not unusual in my home country, as in much of the Americas. In what is now Peru, children were sacrificed by the Incas. Those who hate Columbus and his legacy still must acknowledge that this indigenous practice vanished thanks to the advent of Christianity in their hemisphere. The notion that indigenous life was perfect and Western culture is a locus of all evil is absurd." That is strong. That is an amazing testimony right there. And I think that really is amazing that he gets over there. He's finding these cannibalistic people. And it's not that all natives were cannibalistic.
No.
Not all natives were sacrificing their children,
no,
right?
Of course not.
But he recognized that there were people doing that, and he helped those who were not doing that. And, you know, it really, I think you bring up a good point that, yes, Western civilization has its flaws, but they're not eating people and sacrificing children. You know what I mean?
And I think the other important point is that there was a lot of good native people. Columbus loved them, but they didn't have Christianity. Mm-hmm. And without Christianity, they could never have salvation. Mm-hmm. And he brought that to them.
I want to share a quick little anecdote, and then I want to get your thoughts on what you would say to someone who thinks they should tear down Christopher Columbus statues. First thing I want to share is I was in Hungary recently with my wife, and we were in a place called Liberty Square in Hungary. And I was surprised when I first got in there because there was a statue of Ronald Reagan. And I was like, why is Ronald Reagan here? And I look it up, and the reason they have him there is because they attribute much of the Iron Curtain falling because of Ronald Reagan.
Yes.
That the communists were extolled out of Hungary because of Ronald Reagan. And then I walk a little bit further, and I see a statue, and this statue is beautiful. It's massive. And it says, it said something like this. It said, glory to our Soviet heroes who saved us from the Nazi evil. And it was really interesting to me because they had this statue that predated the Ronald Reagan one, obviously, talking about how the Soviets saved him from the Nazis, but then it was the Soviets who then put him into communism. But after Ronald Reagan helped bring down the Iron Curtain, it's not like they tore down the statue to their Soviet heroes either. But somehow they're able to live in a place where the heroism of the Soviets during World War II was what they built that statue to. They didn't build it to the oppression that communism later brought. So I guess what I'm saying is that, yes, our founding fathers may be flawed, but we're not building statues to their flaws. We're building statues to the good that they did, and maybe we shouldn't be tearing them down. There's a lot of people that disagree, and what are your thoughts towards those who want to change names of schools from that bear the name of Christopher Columbus, that want to tear down statues that have Christopher Columbus? What would you say to someone that wants to do that?
Well, I would say that God works with imperfect men. If he couldn't work with imperfect men, he'd have no one to work with. And you look at Peter. If you focused only on his faults, you'd say, oh, this man cut off the ear of the high priest's servant. This man denied knowing the Savior on three occasions. This man, the Savior said, get behind me, Satan. Mm. If that's all you knew about him, you'd tear down the statue. But we know if that's all you knew about him, you would have missed the mark, the man, in his mission. If all you knew about Columbus is a few of his faults, and you missed that he brought Christianity to this world, that he loved the natives, that he wanted to reconquer Jerusalem for a righteous purpose, then in his will he donates money for a church and a hospital. If you focus on the positive, you'll see this is a great man who ought to be honored.
Mm. Wow.
Cool. That is beautiful. Thank you so much for bringing this knowledge to us. From especially, I appreciate the primary sources because I really do prefer that over people paraphrasing, or, you know, people do a good job at reading a lot about someone instead of actually reading the sources in which they documented themselves or firsthand accounts did. And so,
well, thank you. You were terrific, doing the great work. We appreciate it.
We appreciate you. Thank you for everyone watching the Why I Love America podcast. And until next time, God bless America.